BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Welcome back to Friday Drive Time with old Labour economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Last week it was the BBC, but in the second part of our series on censorship we come closer to the edge and look at the Bristol Evening Post. We go up to the top floor management suite, the Eagle's Nest on Temple Way, to question the integrity of some of the editors, Mike Norton, Deputy Editor Rob Stokes. A Bristol architect George Ferguson is here, and we'll be looking at the paper's coverage of Bristol City Football Club chairman Stephen Lansdowne's bid for a new stadium on Green Fields in Ashton Vale. And following Louis Theroux's TV documentary with Israeli settlers last night, Bristol academic Margaret Jones looks at the Jewish groups in the Middle East and around the world who are campaigning against racism and religious extremism of many Zionists. Instead, these Jewish campaigners want peace and equality with the Arabs. But first, a new initiative in the city to help skilled people, including the jobless, who have no prospect of a mortgage, to build or part build their own homes. The Bristol Community Land Trust signed up its first 150 or so members at a packed meeting in Hamilton House on Stokescroft yesterday.
I'm Bob Patterson. I'm a social enterprise fellow at Salford University, and I've been asked to talk about community land trusts.
Now, one of the main things about community land trusts is that they are attempt to get round what's called the market failure, because the price of housing is skyrocketing beyond most people. How do community land trusts do that?
Well, there are two things. Firstly, they try and cut the costs as low as possible, not incurring development profit, and secondly, by acquiring the land at less than others can acquire it.
How do they do that?
The reason they can do that is because they're actually acquiring the land as a charity or a community benefit society, and they're holding that land in perpetuity for future generations.
Now, community land trusts are also helped by an Act of Parliament as well, a recent one. How is that? How is that Act, and why has Parliament decided to get involved?
Because the then Labour government in 2008 decided that this was a good way of empowering local people to develop housing, and therefore they passed an act which included a definition of what a land trust is.
Now, this is quite a new thing, relatively new in Britain. It's been quite big in America. How many in the UK, how many community land trusts are there so far?
Well, in Scotland there are probably 50 or 60, but in England there are about 90 projects, of which about 15 to 20 are actually doing something.
Now, when you were speaking earlier, you said something quite interesting, which was this is a sort of reinvention of a kind of traditional use of land. What do you mean by that?
What I mean by that is there have been many groups of local people over past centuries that have acquired land and held it, whether they're Quakers, whether they're almshouse trusts, or whether they're even unregistered housing associations. So, and all this came to a stop at the beginning of the 20th century with municipalisation by government. Maybe in the 21st century, where there's less public money around, this has to be seen as the way forward.
For many people out there haven't got a job, they haven't got a lot of money, but they do have skills. Is there a way that people can actually use their skills to build their own home like this?
Yes, it's called sweat equity. You could take your normal clothes off, put on overalls, and bloody well build it yourself. If you're renting it, you'd pay less rent. If you're buying it, you'd pay less to acquire it on a mortgage.
Now, what about people who actually aren't really into the idea of laying foundations and building walls, but they like the idea of sort of finishing off the shell of a house? Is there any chance for people like that?
Yeah, it's called self-finishing, yes. You could probably save about 15% that way. If you're doing self-build and the whole house, it would save between 25 and 30%.
Sounds to me like the developers, when they're making houses and they build them in a way that we don't necessarily want exactly, I mean, they're kind of almost off the shelf, that they actually make quite a lot of money, don't they, when they're actually building and selling these houses. So does it mean that if we are become our own developers through community land trust, that we get that profit, if you want, as part of the equity of the house that we then own?
That's the idea. In the end, there should be less risk with a community land trust property, because you've sorted out before you start on site who's going to live there. When a developer starts a scheme, they've got no idea who's going to live there. So to some extent, profit is a payment for risk.
What would a self-built house actually look like?
Just like any other house. Why should it look any different? Ideally, though, it would have features such as good ecological standards. It would look unlike a developer's house in a row of 200 similar houses. So there'd be some differentiation. But as far as living in it, it should be no different from a house built by a developer.
Now, a lot of little estates and small groups of houses that have been built like this, they tend to have a bit more space for kids to play. How is that then?
Again, because a developer will put the maximum number of houses per acre on, whereas a community land trust is looking at the estate, if you like, on a longer term basis. And if you're going to be creating a community, you need to create some space to breathe for the kids to play and for youths to hang out.
So why is it that the house builder, the normal house builders, don't do that? This is strange, because you'd think that they would know that's what people would want, and they build houses accordingly.
No. The reality is, the more pile them high and sell them as fast as possible at higher price as possible. A land trust is looking at it in a slightly different way. It's looking at it in the long term. A developer is looking at it in the short term.
That is the Bristol Community Land Trust there, offering an alternative route to home ownership or rental by involving the local community as well as future residents in the design and construction of affordable homes. For further information, contact Jackson Moulding at Eco Motive. That's Unit 2 on the Wild Goose Space, the Yard in St Werburgh's. That's down and under the tunnel in the Ashley Vale Action Group area, along Minor Road in St Werburgh's, BS2 9YP. You can also call Jackson if you want on 0117 924 1263, or is on the internet at ecomotive.org. Now, the press is every day becoming more and more powerful, for good or evil. Its influence on men's minds has become so marked that it may with truth be said that the press rules public opinion, rather than public opinion rules the press. That's an extract from J. Arthur Gibbs, A Cotswold Village, Country Life and Pursuits in Gloucestershire, written over a century ago, and well before the age of television, but not before the age of newspapers. Okay, so when did we stop being educated and began to be dumbed down by the media? To hopefully answer some of these questions, I'm joined by Bristol architect and entrepreneur George Ferguson. Now, George, hi and welcome to Drive Time.
Thank you, Tony.
Before we start, must clear one thing up. Are you a merchant venturer?
I am.
And what does it mean to be a merchant venturer?
It's a gathering of people who really are passionate about Bristol. I think there's probably more to it than that in terms of how they're selected, but I was told one day that I'd been elected a merchant venturer. I don't know, what would I do about that?
This is a sort of tap on the shoulder, is it?
Well, almost, yeah. But it's largely there to provide charitable purpose. It is deeply involved in education of the city. I think if I was critical of it, it wasn't involved enough in public education. It is now much more involved in public education, if you can call academies public education, which I do. It's involved in looking after old people and youth projects and many, many things across the city. And it's not anything like masonry. There are no funny handshakes. There are some very decent people there. Few stuffy ones, but that happens in any organisation. I think Bristol's actually lucky for having the merchants. In the old days, they were the slave traders. They were, you know, they were the people who would now be hung up for what they did. But nowadays it's a very different, relaxed organisation. It's pretty open. It has a website. I think you can tell who all the members are. And there's nothing funny about it.
But I mean, still, people see it as a sort of rich elite of the city, and you do have to have a certain standing in society, and you were the president of the Royal Institute for British Architects, or a lot of money, and also, of course, they own vast tracts of land up in Clifton, and they actually own a fantastic, massive financial portfolio. If you go back to the old days of the old merchant venturers and the slave trade days, they were controlling the port weren't they? And they were taking their little cut on every single boat going in and out of the city.
I'm not absolutely sure about that. I mean, nearly all their money is actually in charitable trusts. So the merchant venturers themselves don't own very much, and it's a very small amount of millions compared with the millions that are in charitable trusts. And the biggest charitable trust is one for the elderly. So, and you know, a lot of the almshouses around the city used to be merchant venturers owned, and not all of them are now because they've modernised some of what they're doing. But so it's not an organisation just of rich people. I'm, you know, anybody want to look at my bank account, I can tell you I owe the bank more than they owe me. and I certainly, you know, I'm certainly not one of those rich people. And I can tell you there are people in there who are there because of their passion for Bristol rather than because of the money they've got. Some of them happen to have lots of money, and that can be useful for Bristol because an awful lot of them put some of that money into charitable purposes, either through the merchants or through Quartet, the community foundation, and some of them hold charitable funds of their own.
Well, some people might say, George, that they recruit good chaps like you to be their public face, but actually behind the scenes they're these kind of money dealers, and they're, you know, associated with these sort of investment banks that everybody is saying now is responsible for the crisis.
Well, you could say that, but I cannot think of a merchant venturer who's an investment banker or a banker even. I mean, there are as many professionals as there are business people. And I remember that, you know, there was a row about that. Some of the business people said, well, I can't let these professionals in. They aren't really traders, you know. And it used to be, I think, you had to be three generations of Bristol before you could be. And I came to Bristol to university. So, you know, all that's broken down. I've never done PR. This is the biggest bit of PR I've ever done for the merchant ventures. And I'm never going to, you know, stake my life for them any more than any one of them, I think, would do so. But it's funny that you've asked. You know, I don't think I've ever been asked full on. You're right on the ball about it before, but I'm very open about anything I do, and I happen to think, I mean, I put money into the merchant venture. All of us have to put money into the merchant ventures, which goes into their charitable trust, which does these things. So I don't do it for fun, and I don't even turn up to many of the very few lunches that they have.
Martin, what's your thoughts about the influence of groups like the merchants in the city of Bristol? Because it goes back hundreds of years.
Well, I mean, I'm reminded of the phrase from Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations that business people never get together, even on a social occasion, without some conspiracy against the public being concocted. And I'm not saying that I'm accusing the merchant venturers, but I mean, inevitably, people who do business get together. And of course, there is then suspicion that things go on which shouldn't go on. Absolutely. You know, price fixing, whatever, fixing of contracts and so on. Yeah. I mean, and of course, you know, we do have quite strong laws to prevent that kind of thing from going on. And sometimes it does go on, and sometimes it has to be prosecuted. But most of the time, I imagine, it probably is a sort of social thing more than anything else, isn't it? It's just networking.
Absolutely. I probably knew, you know, a third of them before I was invited to be a merchant venture. And incidentally, I was invited much before I became president of the RIBA. So it wasn't because of that. It was just, I'm an interferer in Bristol matters, and they recognise that. They probably did think that I might give them a slight left-leaning compared with their image. But I don't mind that. I think there is a real move to be more welcoming. When I became a merchant venture, there wasn't a woman merchant venturer.
I thought Margaret Thatcher was an honorary member.
Oh, I think she was an honorary member.
She was the only one.
That would have put me off. But anyway, there wasn't. I remember when I first accepted as a member, I said, well, yeah, now you've elected an architect. And I was the first architect and the only architect ever been a merchant venturer. Well, now you've elected an architect. It's a very small step to elect a woman. Anyway, I'm pleased to say that not that long after, we did start accepting women.
So, but we've got a situation, haven't we, with people that own vast tracts of land in Clifton, these massive investments. Now, surely that's actually quite a dodgy counterbalance to a democratically elected council.
Well, I don't know where all these vast tracts are. I think there's a shared ownership of the Downs, or there's a technical ownership of the Downs or something. And there is a joint committee that runs the Downs between the merchant venturers and the city. But there's not an ownership that can be used for anything except for beneficial use. I mean, I know there's this great discussion. I don't think merchants are going to go out and buy forestry, but they might. They might, but they would treat it in the same way as the National Trust do. I mean, they don't do it. You know, they're not there to rip off people with their ownership. And I think that, in a way, you could say that their ownership of something is a good way of protecting it. But, yeah, I mean, there will always be suspicion, of course. But I can tell you, I've never been in a conversation that's been about anything like price fixing or doing business between other merchants. Because we happen to know each other, there will be people who do business between each other, but not over lunch where sort of broader things are discussed generally.
Now, primarily you're a sort of analyst of the city, you're an architect, you know, I remember coming to see a talk by you a couple of years ago called Fighting the Philistines. Now, what was that, how does that expression actually relate to architecture?
Well, I think that we have a political system that often knows the price of everything but the value of nothing. And the Philistines, to me, are the people who can add everything up but don't really have a feel for what makes a good place. And I try and think way beyond architecture. I think architecture is one vehicle for making a better place. But actually, better places are largely to do with people. You know, you were talking about the Community Land Trust and what they're doing. Now, that is all about, okay, it's about making housing for people, but what it's really about is about making community. And I think the Philistines, to me, are the people who can see buildings and they can add number of houses up, they can add square footage of offices up. They're often the, you know, they're often the estate agents, the surveyors, who I have great fun having a go at, but have absolutely no clue about what makes an appealing place, which is to do with good architecture and good placemaking. It's about having markets and vibrancy and places for people to meet and affordable places so that you don't divide society. I mean, I hate having places that only the posh go to or only the young go to. I mean, there are places for those, but largely one wants a city that's really inclusive. And I think the Philistines are the people who separate the physical from the social.
And so how have you challenged that with some of the spaces that you run, like the tobacco factory and the bar downstairs at Hamilton House on Stokes Croft?
Well, the tobacco factory, I think, was a turning point for me. I was very fortunate in that nobody else could see the value of this great hulk of a building that was part of a much bigger hulk of a building. The tobacco factory, a lot of people won't know, is 1/20th of what stood on that site. It now looks like a big building. When I got hold of it for 200,000 quid at the time, which was more money than I could think about, but somehow I managed to get money together at a time nobody would lend it to you. I had to, you know, borrow off family and things like that and sell things. And then I had no money to do it up. But when I got hold of it, nobody recognized that it had any value. And the estate agents, who I would put in this Philistine bracket at that time, couldn't see that it had any value. They just thought it was a red elephant as opposed to a white elephant. And yet I thought here was an opportunity to demonstrate those things I really believe in, demonstrate to my clients and to politicians and others that very economically you can take a place, fill it with lots of different types of users, don't be posh about it, and that you can bring it to life, and what's more, you can bring the aura of what it does to the streets around it and bring those to life. So it's exceeded my expectations, I have to say. So there's been an awful lot of luck down the way. And now, you know, we now have the theatre and the creative industry workspace, and I live at the top, and so do others. And we've got the eating and the drinking. We've got the market in the car park. We now got a brewery down the road. We now got another theatre and dance studio down the road, a bakery, a cake maker. And that is about placemaking. And Well, I think the delight of it to me is, and it's, you know, it's not all planned. It's sort of sucking and seeing as I went along. It's slow architecture. It's slow development. The delight to me is that you might bump into old 80-something-year-old Harold sitting in the corner, you know, who's chatting up some of the bar staff, and you might see young mums with their babies coming in, or somebody a bit potty from the hostel down the road coming in. And I just love the mix, and that is brilliant to me, and that is what placemaking's about.
Now, I brought you in here actually just talk about censorship, at least what I would call censorship, because you used to have a weekly column in the Bristol Evening Post, which for some reason stopped back in July last year.
Yeah, that was funny. I've been writing for 2.5 years the Evening Post, the By George column, and which was their name, which I thought was fine. It's better than some of the other names that come up before. And they gave me amazing freedom, actually, to write on anything I liked, and I took more and more freedom as I went along. And it would not just be about local issues, but it usually had a local relevance. I think that it got a bit strained to a certain extent when the Evening Post took a very, very strong view about the football club and what it was doing. And
this is the proposed move of the stadium from Ashton Gate to Ashton Vale,
which I've never opposed. Although I think a city does better when it puts those sort of provisions at its heart rather than at its edge, but. And that's actually what I like about Ashton Gate, although it's not at the heart of the city, it's the heart of a community, and it's its old home, and it has real relevance to the fans. No, the real battle came over the proposal to put a supermarket, and when I say a supermarket, I mean a regional shopping centre. I mean a supermarket that is twice as big as the Asda at Bedminster. It is 40% bigger than any other supermarket in Bristol. It is a regional shopping centre that sells as much other goods as it does food. This is what's proposed. And to be landed on this football pitch, this giant thing that would be like the IKEA at Eastville in terms of it looming over the surrounding houses. And because they were so blinded by this plan of the new stadium, and they believed that the new stadium was dependent on this giant supermarket, it was a load of rubbish. The new stadium, the sale of the stadium to the supermarket would provide in net terms 15% of the value of the stadium, which the chairman of Bristol City Football Club could bring out of his back pocket, as he'd bring out of his tax, easily bring out of his tax savings from moving to Guernsey. He could bring the whole lot out of that. And because I was writing about that in quite a strong manner and said that the Evening Post was rather aiding and abetting Sainsbury's and the football club in this plan, Mike Norton, the editor, saw fit to, I think he read it on his holiday and coughed into his soup. And
you didn't deliberately put that column in while he was on holiday, George, did you?
I didn't know he was on holiday. And I got nothing against Mike, but he obviously got twitchy about it. And to him, aiding and abetting was meant that I was that they were joining in some form of criminal activity, which is not what it means. It's used in that way somehow or other. So he said, suspend his column for a week until I get back. And actually, I was going on holiday, so I said, okay, we'll talk about it. I'm going on holiday. We'll talk about it in the autumn. And I had a conversation with Mike in the autumn when I got back, and or possibly even stretching into the winter. And we agreed, I think, that I just don't go back on things. I rather like moving forwards. I'd rather like doing things 2 or 3 years at a time. So as it was, I decided I'll draw a line under that. Mike will accept other columns from me on, you know, maybe or features, although I haven't done one since. But yes, I think it was just pushing that to him, it was pushing the relationship too far. They were taking a very strong line in one direction, and I was taking a very strong line in the other direction. But actually, I think that's what features should be about in, I mean, not features, what personal columns should be about in newspapers. And you'll see Simon Jenkins in The Guardian, for instance, being not at all Guardian-like in some of the things he writes. So I think it's healthy, and I think The Guardian is a better newspaper for that open-mindedness.
But surely if Mike hadn't suspended your column, you'd still be writing it today.
Well, I might, and I might not. I mean, I was getting to a point when I was thinking, can I go on doing this week? I'm full of admiration for weekly columnists. It is tough, you know. Yeah, just thinking up a new subject and getting down and writing it, and it's usually at the weekend because it's, you know, that's when the deadline is for the weekly column. It's been amazingly relaxing not having to do it. But having said that, I've now started my own blog, which I think will hit the internet next week.
Okay, well, we look forward to that. Now, what's your thoughts about the Evening Post's coverage then of the story? Aiding and abetting is quite strong language to use, isn't it? Do you really think that there is that there's been an editorial decision at the Post to support what the move to the Greenfield site at Ashton Vale?
Oh no, absolutely. I mean, that is absolutely clear. I think that, to be honest, I think the Evening Post has gone over the top about it, and I think that, not deliberately, but by what they've done, that it's stoked an awful lot of resentment and hatred, and I think that is very, very sad, because we have a community of football players, and we have a community around Ashton, I mean football fans, and some of them are the same people. The community of football fans, actually, I mean, extraordinary, I hadn't discovered before, the majority seem to live outside the city boundary, the majority. Mm. So when you see a petition to do something in Ashton that the football club supports, it's largely football fans, and it's largely people who live outside the city boundary. And then that is measured against a petition that is 99% people who live within the city boundary, and that's not, yeah, so that's unfortunate. So I think there has been a blind support, and have a look at the Stop Sainsbury's website, because an awful lot of myths have been created around this story, and the Stop Sainsbury's website has revealed seven misleading facts that have been repeated time and time again so people believe them, about jobs, about traffic, about also about the effect on local trade, and about air quality, about all those things. We have been misled, and I think it's very important that those issues are aired, otherwise people go on repeating them and believing them.
But what about this view that this is just simply a property scam where, you know, cheap agricultural land on the edge of the city has been bought up for pennies, you know, and then once the football club get planning permission for the stadium, suddenly the value of that land overnight literally shoots up 100 or 1,000 times, you know. So you're laying out whatever it is, 20-30 grand for a bit of a field, and that overnight suddenly becomes worth 20 or 30 million.
Absolutely. I mean, it is an extraordinary thing in our property world that planning permission gives people a lot of money. Now, that can be done in a good way, but if you know, a genuine developer who is developing land and providing a physical result is very different from a land speculator who's buying cheap land and then flogging it on after planning permission. And yes, millions can change hands as a result of that. So I don't think this is all about a property scam, but it's absolutely true that some people will, if this whole town green thing is resolved, that some people will be making a lot of money out of it. Now, I think that it's very odd that Steve Lansdowne, who's not a stupid man, found himself buying a bit of land, presumably without the advice that it could become a town green. So he must have been taken a bit by surprise. But to to tell people that that was the same as stealing, I think he said something like that, I would have thought was just a bit of an overreaction.
Now, talking to some of the local residents down and shopkeepers down around Ashton Vale area where this stadium is proposed, they talk of quite serious intimidation by football fans and threats.
I don't know so much about it. Some of the shopkeepers, I think, have had a hard time. I think it's more the residents around Ashton Vale who have been part of this application or been supporting this application for a town green. Now, whatever side anybody may be on this argument, it is completely inexcusable for people to have suffered the sort of intimidation that they've suffered. And I think part of that is that some of the fans have felt that they've been given license by some of the local media and by the City Football Club into doing so. Now, I don't believe that the local media or the Bristol City Football Club intend people to be intimidated to that extent. But I think that they have, to a certain extent, encouraged that. But, I mean, it has been very, very frightening, some of the stories that have come out. I mean, I have, extraordinarily enough, I mean, there was an element of a boycott of the tobacco factory because of this by football fans. It lasted only 2 or 3 weeks. There were some horrible threats to us on blogs by people on their, you know, on their keyboards, which is very easy to be very nasty when you're on your keyboard. But do you know, nobody has been unpleasant to me. So I go in when all the fans are there and when it's absolutely, you know, when it's packed with football supporters, I get on very well with them. I don't think the real people, what I call the real people who show their faces, are that bad. I think an awful lot of these threats are cowardly ones that come from people who are hidden.
Now, George, you've got some quite well-respected views on the way the city should look in the future, and our reporter, Marina Morris, has been out on the streets of the city this week to see what you think about the rights and wrongs of the planning system and some of the big new city developments in recent years. Firstly, she asks, how does town planning and architecture in the city affect you?
How does the architecture of Bristol affect you?
I think we're lucky. It inspires me, really, because I'm an artist. It helps me to open doors and expand my creativity. In England, well, in Britain, really, all over the country, we've got beautiful art buildings coming up and old buildings, a lot of history to it. I think it's really good, you know, for the children.
I think it's nice to live in a place where there's architecture that you can be proud of, and we certainly have some kind of nice buildings in and around Bristol, and obviously things like the Suspension Bridge, and which are really iconic of Bristol as well.
Okay, it's beautiful, do you know what I mean? There's so much history there, and it means that people look after the area a lot better. It means you get more visitors. I'm young, but I can appreciate it. It's like when I sit here and I look at what they're doing over here. Do you know what I mean? It's all the new buildings they're putting up around here. It's just, I think it's just a waste of money. Absolute waste of money. They should be spending it on more important things, like maybe fixing this up. Because I live in a hostel in the middle of Bristol, and I'm actually a recovered drug addict, right? And the council, they put all their money into the wrong things. Don't put it into places that need it and people that need it.
The architecture of Bristol, it depends where you are. In Lawrence Weston, it's not so inspiring. Clifton, it's different.
Well, it doesn't affect me that much because I don't come from Bristol. Got a lot of history, you know?
Right. Now, that was some good remarks there. I mean, what's telling is that people are pointing to Clifton and the Suspension Bridge and the old things. We are extraordinarily fortunate in Bristol. I think it's got the most interesting background of almost any other city outside London. And I say outside London because London does have just about a bit of everything. But Bristol, if you would take any foreigner to any city to see everything that had happened in this country, possibly both good and ill, you would take them to Bristol. And that wasn't said by me, it was said by Sir John Summerson, who is a great architectural historian, and would be turning in his grave. He saw some of the things that have happened since. But I think we have a great city and we spoil that at our peril. And that's where I come back to the Philistines. I think that we have too often sold out. We too often compromised. We've too often allowed our politicians to go along, get too cozy with some of the developers, and we've ended up with a horrible mess that should have been a real triumph. Places like Temple Quay and Cannon's Marsh could have been absolute world beaters, and they're just the normal commercial development, and that is sad on some of the best sites you could find in any cities in Europe.
Well, Marina also asked George about Cabot Circus and some of the new office blocks that you were just talking about.
Well,
are the new office buildings and Cabot Circus adding to our architectural heritage?
No, I think they're trying to design a new architectural heritage. You know, I think they're trying to give a new birth to it. Modern, that's what they call it these days, isn't it? Or contemporary. I think it's moving away from it, to be honest.
I think it is because, I mean, in this day and age, and with, you know, popular culture and people and big up-and-coming shopping areas, I mean, they're quite important, really, to quite a lot of people. And they kind of put Bristol on the map. I mean, if you want to come somewhere and, you know, have a good shopping day out, I mean, Cabot Circus is perfect. And the fact that it looks nice as well is kind of great.
They're not adding to any sort of heritage, architectural, cultural, or in any other way. It's just... it's to make money. It's simple as that. And it's very functional. Doesn't look very pretty. In fact, it looks... coming in to Bristol, the impact it has is just almost like a solid block of stone, and there's no feature to it whatsoever.
I think Cabot Circus is overrated, really. It's just something or nothing. I don't think it does add anything to it at all.
I think Cabot Circus is a bit of a disappointment. I thought it was going to be something really nice. I mean, if you go to Bath and you see what they've done in Bath, they've built in their new shopping centre, it blends in with Bath. This is all too... although Bristol isn't very old anymore, so I suppose it sort of blends in, but I think they could have done something a bit nicer.
Well, we had to fight back against the out-of-town shopping. My way of fighting back would have been to have extended Broadmead into the city centre. I mean, somebody referred to Bath there. Now, Bath Shopping Centre, love it or hate the architecture, I think it's a bit theatrical with its sort of fake Georgian architecture, but it provides streets right in the heart of Bath. Cabot Circus is a sort of semi-out-of-town shopping centre. It's one that nearly everybody drives to, and it's got a massive, great car park. And I think that the places that work as cities are where they bring all that activity right into the middle of them, not just as, you know, as you arrive at the end of the motorway into the city. Birmingham have put their Bullring development much more in the heart of Birmingham. So that's not an architectural comment. That's about the opportunity of these big retail centres to bring life to a city rather than to take life out of it. Architecturally, I think it's awful outside, and I think it's quite fun inside. You know, the covered bit and the roof and those streets on different levels, I think, are quite fun. The outside is dire, and it's all about roads and blank frontages, and is exactly what a city shouldn't be about.
It's the sort of thing that people feel inspired to drive their car in through windows. I don't know if you saw that someone actually drove their car at crazy speed straight into the windows at Cabot Circus because maybe they didn't like the look of it as they were driving.
Well, the House
around.
Of Fraser window, which is, I think, it's the biggest retail window in the country or something. Anyway. Yeah, but then I prefer to have windows than these blank walls that that some architect has just given lots of different materials to try and cheer it up. But it's still a blank wall. It's got no life, and it's horrible.
Now, Marina's final question out on the streets was about the environment and whether that the architecture that we're seeing at the moment is actually environmentally friendly.
Should new buildings be designed to reduce our environmental impact?
Definitely, and I don't think they are doing that, are they? There's no friendly, you know, what they call it, green or whatever. It's all electric, gas. They lie to us, I reckon, all these people in power, to keep the crowd, the psychological control, under control, you know, but where blatantly they're doing the opposite. It's like the truth's so blatant you can't see it.
Yeah, I think so. I think that's probably important, and, I mean, lots of buildings now have got things kind of inbuilt with reducing your carbon footprint, and yeah, it is important to kind of preserve for the future.
Always, always. In fact, there are buildings that can be designed that use virtually no power whatsoever.
Yes, definitely. We unlike politicians that just do things for 5 years, we should do things for 500 years, not just 5 years. You know, anything we do is for our children and their children and their children.
What are your favourite buildings in Bristol?
College Green, one. Well, I'm in the west of England, so two. A few. I don't know, I like the churches, to be honest. I'm not very good with names, but there's... St. Stephen's, Curran Street.
Suspension Bridge is kind of hugely iconic of Bristol. Well, Cabot Circus is quite important to me nowadays. So the Georgian House on Park Street.
Redcliffe has it, I love it. Absolutely beautiful place. And Bristol Cathedral, because I spend a lot of time in the churches, because I find them very peaceful and relaxing. And Temple Meads. I like Temple Meads, I think it's beautiful.
The cathedral, the Landogger Trail pub. I like the Bristol Centre as well, the harbour side itself.
I'd say I like this church, although it's derelict. The cathedral, Bristol Cathedral.
I love the guy who says we should be doing things for 500 years rather than for 5 years, for our children, for our grandchildren. I think that's the essence, and that's what sustainable building is about. That's what sustainable development is about. I think we should actually judge every single application in the city about whether it is making it a greener, better place or not. Every single application, every single policy decision should be about whether it's making it a greener, better place.
But it isn't, George, is it? And as we keep hearing here, really the developers can virtually do what they want because local people don't get a third party right of appeal to these decisions.
Well, there is there's usually an ability to comment on planning applications, but I think a lot of people feel powerless. But and often the decisions seem to be more commercial ones than ones that are about benefiting the community. That's why this has become Supermarket City. I come back to the supermarket. It's not just about this giant supermarket proposal at Ashengate. Wherever you walk in this city now, we're seeing less of the small independent shops and more of the supermarkets. And they are killing that independent local business where the money recirculates within the community instead of being grabbed and taken out of it to some great central HQ.
So when is this final decision going to be made then on the Sainsbury's?
Well, it's going to a special planning committee, on the evening of the 2nd of March at 5:30. I think there will be a lot of people from the Ashen community outside the council house making a bit of noise in order to encourage the councillors to do what they did last time, be brave, stand up against the intimidation, stand up against the recommendation they might get from their officers, and do the right thing.
Well, entrepreneur and architect and merchant venturer, George Ferguson, thanks very much for joining us on Friday Drive Time this evening.
Thanks, Tony.
Bristol Community FM 93.2. Your voice, your choice.
Now, Louis Theroux's TV documentary, The Ultra Zionists, was transmitted on BBC Two last night, and it showed Israeli settlers may themselves be the most dangerous religious extremists in the Middle East, maybe on the planet. This is again a hot issue because following the breakdown of so-called peace talks again at the end of last year, Israeli settlement programme in Palestinian land has resumed. By no means all Jews around the world and in Israel support the settlement programme, in which mainly white Eastern European Jews are taking land and homes from the Palestinian Arabs. One danger being that many of these ultra-Zionists consider themselves a kind of master race and believe the land given to Moses and the Middle Eastern Jews by God about 1500 BC, according to the Torah or the Old Testament, some 3,500 years ago, is still theirs for the taking. Well, Bristol academic and Gaza Link campaigner Margaret Jones spoke to me recently about Jewish groups in the Middle East and around the world who are campaigning against racism and religious extremism that they see of many Zionists. Instead, these Jewish campaigners want peace and equality with the Arabs.
Well, it's Monica Margaret Jones, and I've been involved with Bristol Gaza Link mainly through going on one convoy and also by helping to fundraise for the aid that went with the various convoys.
there seem to be quite a lot of groups actually within Israel itself and in the diaspora of Jewish people around the world that actually have quite a lot of problems with the Jewish state.
Yes, well, I think quite a few Jews have woken up in recent years, particularly when they've seen things like house demolitions and how the Palestinians are gradually losing their land, land which is nominally to be theirs and given back to them when the military occupation ends, is actually being taken away. So there's someone like Jeff Halper, who helped to found the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions, and he says there's a point for Israelis when what he calls the envelope, a kind of comfortable safety zone, breaks, and you find yourself taking the side, as he did, of someone whose house was being torn down. And he ended up having a gun pointed at him by an Israeli soldier as he lay on the ground with this Palestinian man who was sobbing. And he founded the Committee Against House Demolitions to resist the demolitions. Then there's Machzom Watch, which means checkpoint watch, and this is a group of Israeli women who stand at the checkpoints. As many people will know, a lot of abuse of human rights goes on at those checkpoints, and these women stand there to either note what happens or to see that it doesn't happen because they're there. Then there are the rabbis for human rights. They're not all rabbis, but a lot of them are rabbis, and they will go with the olive harvest in the autumn. That's one of the things I know they do. And they have been known to climb the trees to prevent the soldiers coming in or the settlers coming in and trying to stop the people harvesting their crop. So that's another really useful thing, that a practical thing that some Israelis are doing. Then I don't know how well it's known, but Adam Shapiro and a Palestinian woman called Hawaida jointly formed the International Solidarity Movement that quite a few Bristolians have been with, that does human rights monitoring and direct action on the West Bank. So that's another thing that Israelis are doing. Then, really, in the diaspora, both in Britain and the States, there are things like Jews Against the Occupation, which is largely an East Coast-based movement of Jewish people in the States. And, well, the name stands for itself, but they've also been with International Solidarity Movement. There's also Jewish Voice for Peace, which is becoming quite articulate and, for a very small organisation, quite powerful, largely through skillful use of the internet, organising petitions and lobbying, and they are becoming very effective. And listeners might like to know that the Massachusetts Institute of Technology has voted to divest, take out its investments from Israel, which is largely due to this kind of lobbying. Then in Britain, there's a fairly well-established organisation now, which is called Jews for Justice for the Palestinians, and that's probably one of the older ones. It's been going, well, over a decade, I think. And then there's a more recent one, which is called simply Jews for the Boycott of Israeli Goods, which is probably a bit more radical and does call very vocally for the boycott of Israeli goods. If you go on a convoy, you will actually meet Jewish people travelling with the convoy who feel quite strongly about what Israel is doing to Gaza. So it's all around, actually.
Why is it, do you think, that this particular conflict, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, seems to be still going for so many years? I mean, there are other conflicts around. There's Afghanistan, Iraq. But why does this problem with the Arabs and the Jews in Israel just keep going on and on?
Well, people talk a lot about peace and why do they keep fighting each other and there should be peace. But quite honestly, there has never been a conflict in the history of the world where you can build peace on the basis of injustice. And I always say to people, supposing you've had your not just your house stolen, supposing you've had your phone, mobile phone, taken away by a mugger, if people said to you, well, shut up and don't try to get your phone back and don't try to get the mugger punished, just be quiet and make peace with the mugger, well, everyone would see that that was nonsense. And this is exactly the situation for the Palestinians. Every day on the West Bank, more land is stolen, more colonial settlements are imposed, there are injustices in the courts every day, even within Israel. And as long as that goes on, there is going to be no peace. You've got a situation where one side has one of the most powerful armies in the world and possibly nuclear weapons. The other side, there are a few militants with rockets who really, they don't even have an army as such. It's a completely unequal power relation. It's a colonial relation. It's a relationship of a most brutal military occupation until that ends. And this is increasingly what Jews are beginning to say around the world. Until that ends, you will never have justice. And now these Jewish critics of Israel are a minority, but they are a growing minority. And I think if there's one thing that gives me hope for the future, it is that at last, you know, there are many people standing up, Jew and non-Jew, saying there has to be justice for Palestine. This is very hopeful, I think.
Just before Christmas, we had the resumption of the building of settlements by the Israeli state, because that what they've said is that the peace process has broken down. What is the problem with the settlements? Because these Jewish settlements are not on existing Palestinian settlements. They're generally on hilltops and places which aren't built on. So what's the problem? It's just basically building new housing, isn't it?
Well, I'm glad you said they're on hilltops, because that's part of the point. Across the West Bank, there are military roads and there are settler roads, which only Jews are allowed to go on. You tell people that, it just sounds incredible. You know what? You're a Palestinian who's lived in that area for centuries, and now there's a beautiful modern road and you can't go on it. You have to use a farm track. But the fact is that they're building there what Jeff Halper of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions calls the Matrix of Control. This is a network of military roads that run between the settlements. The settlements then form the function of fortresses, rather like Norman castles. They look down on the Arab village below, they dominate the hilltop, they have all kinds of infrared equipment and the means to spy on the houses, and it is a way of keeping the Palestinian population subjugated. When I was in Marza a few years ago, it's a little village which is completely overlooked by a huge settlement of Ariel, which is 20,000 people in modern houses overlooking the valley. There was a family went up one evening to drink coffee on their roof, and within 10 minutes there was an army jeep at the door and soldiers banging on the door and saying, "You've been drinking coffee on the roof, don't try to lie to us, you get down below or there will be trouble." And the people cannot even live freely in their own village where their families have lived for generations, because they are being spied on by a military outpost situated up on the hill.
So what's the problem with having a cup of coffee on your roof?
Well, I wish I knew what the problem was, but I suppose the assumption is that they can look back at Ariel and maybe they're up to something. But also the point is to keep the people feeling subjugated and cowed. And a lot of harassment goes on. The reason we were in Marta was because the army had been in, arresting young people apparently at random in the middle of the night, throwing sound bombs, frightening the kids, breaking windows, really just carrying on like a lot of drunk on a Friday night. And when internationals went into the village, we said, what are we doing here? We don't seem to be doing anything. We're just sleeping overnight and nothing's happening. And they said, nothing's happening because internationals are here. When you go away, it will all start again. And we heard through third parties that's exactly what happened. As soon as the foreigners left, the bullying started again. The whole policy is to make life very unpleasant for the Palestinians, and to some extent it has worked, because every year hundreds and thousands of Palestinians leave, often the most educated, the most capable, the people with money, the people with relatives abroad. They leave. And it's only the people who can't get out who stay there, or people who are very committed to keeping their land, and they will stay there clinging on for dear life. But it's not so different from what happened with the conquest of the American West. And I think that's why settlers from America are very sympathetic to Jewish settlers in Israel, because it's replicating their history. There's a land grab going on, and I think unless people understand that there is a land grab going on, they won't really grasp what is happening between Israelis and Palestinians on the West Bank. There's a desperate struggle going on by people to hang on to their land, and if we can't feel for these people that are being threatened with total dispossession, you know, I think we really are missing the point.
Academic and Bristol Gaza Link campaigner Margaret Jones there speaking to me a couple of weeks ago. Now, Martin, you watched this Louis Theroux TV documentary Ultra Zionists last night on BBC Two. Do you think that some of these Zionists really are some of the most dangerous religious extremists in the world?
Well, they're dangerous because of their location. I mean, they are at a flashpoint for a potential Third World War, so their prejudice is of particular importance. I mean, there's plenty of people with silly ideas, but they're people with silly ideas sitting on a time bomb.
Well, that's one way of looking at it. And are they actually religious extremists? We use this word, bandy this word around, and it's very often applied to Muslims,
you know,
isn't it?
Yes, I mean, we have to define what we mean by religious extremists. But yeah, they hold views which are not open to rational argument, let's put it that way. They believe that God gave them the land, and you can't argue with people like that. It's not to do with who's got the piece of paper that says it owns it, or how many people have voted for it or anything. It's just God told them, and that's good enough for them.
Right, Martin Summers, Old Labour Oxford economist, thank you very much. Well, that's all for this week. Coming up next, it's the Sky News at 7 o'clock. Thanks very much to our guest in the first hour, Lib Dem councillor for Eastville, Steve Comer, in fact, is how he pronounces it, and to reporter Marina Morris and to George Ferguson, and of course to our resident Old Labour economist you just heard there, Martin Summers. Next week, as promised, a case of heavy vetting, MI5 at the BBC. Plus, the council say there are only 7 homeless people in the city, a figure which has come down from 18,000 a couple of years ago when they changed the system for allocating homes. We take a tour around one of Bristol City Council's most beautiful but neglected housing sites, about to be bulldozed and sold off to developers. So if you're on broadband internet, you can hear all our previous Friday drive times, including this programme's 5-point economic recovery plan, a report on mobile phones, masts and wireless safety, etc. At thisweek.org.uk. That's thisweek.org.uk. That's enough talk for tonight. Top of the bill at 10, it's Mashup to the Weekend, woven together by DJ Bungle from 10 o'clock. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol.